And one of the most interesting things about this was the immediate assumption that the internet was going to function.
Yeah.
Right. So we sent everyone home expecting the internet to be this reliable thing. When, if anyone understands the way the internet's put together, it isn't owned and operated by any one or two entities.
Yeah. It's a patchwork of different
It's more than
systems
a patchwork.
Involved.
It's,
yeah.
It's every endpoint on the internet is essentially part of the internet.
Yeah.
They're part of the whole switching and packet switching apparatus that sends and receives data through the internet. So it's, you know, if there's a weak link in the internet, it's there, and it's no one's really responsible to point it out and fix it. It's up to the individual participants. So to send everyone home and expect the internet to stay up and work just fine was really a crapshoot. And it's amazing that for most of this time, mostly the internet has withstood the traffic. There's been some hacking and some security breaches and those kind of things.
Oh, yeah.
But for the most part, you know, from an infrastructure perspective, it's held up pretty well.
Mm-hmm. So I think you kind of touched on this already, but I was going to ask, like, how does COVID differ from, like you know, for example, H1N1? But, I mean, obviously there's a lot more involved than just worrying about 20% of your workforce not being there. You have to worry about, like, 100% of your workforce not being there and how they're going to operate, you know, remotely, and if that's even a feasible thing for your business. Are there any other big, like, differences between COVID and, like, H1N1, for example, from your perspective for what you do? Like,
well, from the medical point of view,
yeah.
I mean, obviously, you know, you mitigate, you put things in place to keep people safe. We had cleaning protocols, we wore masks, we social distanced, we did all the things that the CDC recommended you do. But for most companies, it was just safer to leave people at home under the assumption that they're staying safe and essentially isolating themselves in their home and with their family. Mm-hmm. And that worked well. And now that we have a vaccine, the challenge now is how do you come back?
Yeah.
How do organizations now address this return to the workplace amid all of this, you know, discussion about the vaccination status and, you know, is it right to force vaccinations?
Yeah. Is it even effective at this point? Because, you know, it's something I touched on last week on my show. I brought up a story that was from NewJersey.com, actually. We were reporting on the increase in cases as of last week, and there was a blip in there that just kind of blew my mind. It said that I think it was like 93% of the current cases, well, 93% of the cases as of last week were of this Delta variant variety. So, I mean, look, I'm not a doctor or anything, but it seems like the vaccine is just not, you know, the ones that we have right now aren't suited to handle this variant, if that's really what's going on. So, I mean, where do you see this going in the next, like, couple months? Do you think we're going to re-enter a lockdown phase? Do you think, like, you know, like, what should businesses be preparing for as we still go through this?
Well, I think there's a couple of assumptions we should make.
One
is that if this variant and the other variants were truly naturally generated variations, they'll probably continue.
Yeah.
Right? The other option is if there are some people who believe this virus was man-made or man-launched or engineered in some way, well, then who's to say the variants aren't also?
Yeah.
Right? So either way, you should, I think, have as a planning assumption that this will continue for some time.
Yeah.
Now, whether or not the variants are or the vaccines are effective against the variants or even the baseline COVID, I mean, I'll leave that up to the epidemiologists and the scientists and the data to say that. From my point of view, we have to assume there is some effectiveness with the vaccines, and we should encourage vaccination. But we should also understand that we can't stop the world and wait for...
Yeah.
You are?
Okay. Yeah, we're on a different page.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry about that, folks. A little interruption here. But I'm sorry, Tim. We kind of got cut off there.
So the one assumption I think I would tell any business or any leader is to assume this will continue, that this will continue to come in waves of severity, whether they're not severe or not. So the question is, how do we run our businesses and continue our business knowing this as the future? Well, I think the best time to start is now, right? So I'm a proponent of companies returning to the workplace,
mm-hmm.
but understanding that, you know, you just can't say it's a binary switch. We shut it all down in March of 2020,
yeah.
and now we're going to bring it all back in September of 2021.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to be gradual. It's got to be thoughtful. So some of the same things that we've been doing in terms of social distance, physical distancing, you know, if your workforce, if some of them are productive at home, leave them home.
Mm-hmm.
If some of them want to come to the office, bring them in, spread them out.
Mm-hmm.
Why not have people wear masks when they're in common spaces, right? Why not have that happen?
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether or not you force vaccination status, that's got a lot of unintended consequences. And mm-hmm. I'll tell you one right now. If you look at unemployment before mm-hmm. COVID, it was very hard to fill positions.
Yeah.
Unemployment was at a record low, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if we think that the current levels of unemployment are purely driven by COVID and we come out of COVID, we're going to get back to those same levels and probably even lower because of the amount of retirees and things that have happened since. So you're going to have essentially people who are leaving the workforce because you're forcing them mm-hmm. to leave the workforce because you're requiring them to be vaccinated.
Yeah.
Will you be able to replace them?
Mm-hmm.
And will your replacement be vaccinated people? I mean, if you force people to not come to work because they're not vaccinated, you can't replace them with people who aren't vaccinated. That would
yeah.
be opening you up to some lawsuit
yeah.
and discrimination, right? So the question is, look at the demographics right now. If we're at 50% of the population is vaccinated, in New Jersey it's 60% of the population, and it's probably in the 75% of the adult population. That means there's a large population who isn't vaccinated.
Mm.
And the question is, look at your business. If you feel or suspect, one way to do it is just an anonymous survey. Find out how many of them are vaccinated or not.
Mm-hmm.
And based on that, it becomes a strategic decision.
Yeah.
Can you afford to force vaccination? It's really because, you know, some argue that even if you're fully vaccinated, well, now they're suggesting that even vaccinated people.
Yeah, of course. That's
right?
Why. Yeah, that's been like my biggest yeah. hang up with, you know, with getting the vaccine. And look, you know, from my perspective, like I got COVID back in March, right? And I understand that a lot of people have suffered from this like severely and have died. And, you know, I'm not discounting that by any means. But, you know, for me, when I had it, it was, you know, I've had worse colds, to be perfectly frank with you. You know, granted, it was about a week of just kind of feeling crummy, but, you know, for somebody like me who's, you know, a young, relatively healthy guy, you know, a couple extra pounds on me, I could certainly stand to lose. But, you know, when I'm presented with the, you know, the prospect of having to take the vaccine, I have to ask myself, like, what's the point? You know, like, number one, I had it already, so if I get it again, number one, the odds of me getting it again are probably very low just based on the antibodies. But when those run out, you know, if I get it, I'm going to be probably okay just based on my prior experience, right? But at the same time, so why would I get the vaccine if it doesn't even prevent me from getting it? And even if I get the vaccine, I could still get it and transmit it to somebody else. It just seems kind of like unnecessary for somebody in my situation. Now, so obviously someone who's older and, you know, has 6 or 7 other comorbidities, by all means, you know, at the end of the day, talk to your doctor. But, you know, that would make more sense, I think, you know, from the outside looking in for that person to get the vaccine. So I don't know, there's a lot of younger people, I think, who feel the same way I do. And, you know, that's a concern, I guess, probably for employers. Like, you know, are they going to be able to recruit young talent when, you know, they might not necessarily feel like they need the vaccine? I don't know. There's so many different things going on here, but like,
well, there is, Chris, if I may, there is a solution that's not being discussed, right?
Yeah.
So I agree with you. I think the mistake that's been made over the last 18 months is mm-hmm. to really discount the natural immunity.
100%.
Right? So let's assume the numbers are right, and we look at the amount of people who have had COVID
mm-hmm.
that are known, and then you add in some factor of unknowns.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people have had COVID and survived.
Yeah.
So if you were going to, as an employer, force people to be vaccinated, and you force them to show proof of vaccination, why wouldn't you also say show proof of immunity
mm-hmm.
and have them have a test that shows what their antibody levels are
yeah.
and an attestation from a medical professional? Why wouldn't that be as equally as effective? Had we had this approach,
mm-hmm.
I think, frankly, more people would be apt to get vaccinated, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because what you're saying to them, it's not a binary world. It's not unvaccinated or vaccinated. What you're saying is there's being unvaccinated and dodging the COVID, hiding, dodging, doing whatever you're doing, never getting it. There's being vaccinated and hopefully never getting it. But there's also a middle world, which is where you get it, you survive it, and now you have natural immunity.
Exactly.
And that should have some weight.
Yeah, well, you know, not to get conspiratorial, but that has to make money for, you know, Big Pharma and Fauci and the boys up there. But, you know, besides the point, we're not here to beat on Tony. But, it's interesting seeing how this thing is, you know, transpired from the get-go. There's been a very, you know, my biggest complaint from the beginning has been that there's been no real, like, goalpost, right? There's no, because I, and again, I'm not a doctor, but I, you know, just based on my historical knowledge of pandemics and diseases and stuff, like, we're probably going to be dealing with this for, you know, indefinitely into eternity, right? Like, you think about it, like, the Black Plague, the bubonic plague is still around, right? Mm-hmm. And that, you know, was blowing up, what, in, like, the 1300s, 1200, you know, medieval times. So COVID's never going to, we're just never going to get rid of it, unfortunately, you know, whether, you know, despite what people may say. So, like, it, but at a certain point, you got to kind of, let me get back to where I was going with this. Yeah. There was no, like, goalpost, right, where they were like, okay, you know, as morbid as it may sound to say, like, okay, we have 1,000 deaths a month. That's fine. You know, that's the benchmark we want to hit. You know, granted, nobody wants to hear that as, like, a marker of success, like how many deaths you have. But, I mean, in reality, that's how you realistically need to approach something like this because, I mean, you look at all the side effects of the lockdowns, right? You have people, you know, committing suicide and, you know, record rates of depression and divorce and financial struggle. And, you know, there's more death that's going to come indirectly from, you know, the response to the pandemic than the pandemic itself. So, I mean, I don't know. Have you seen any indication of when, like, any benchmark? Like, is there a corporate kind of sense of when we're going to get to a point where this is just tolerable and we can go kind of get back to normal? Or we're just going to keep playing it by ear?
Yeah, honestly, you know? I mean, you have to go back again to what I originally said. So expert planners like myself had plans.
Yeah.
We never envisioned this, right?
So of course.
There was no goalpost in our planning before. And now that this is evolving and unfolding, it's impossible to set goalposts because we don't know what tomorrow is going to be.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah. So the nature has to be agility. It has to be flexibility. Mm-hmm. And frankly, that's what resilience means, right? So the best run organizations, the best run companies can pivot and they could be agile. And if anything, this should be a wake-up call to companies that says, this is the world you live in. If it isn't this global pandemic, it's a ransomware, it's an internet crash, it's a, you know, global terrorism type of issue. There will be things that will impact your business that you can't foresee. So you have to be resilient and you have to think about how to maneuver and pivot. I mean, I look at what some of these restaurants have done.
Yeah.
It's been amazing how they've just, I mean, I think of Chick-fil-A, right? How when that moved into Flemington here, the first day it opened, it had the circle jammed and gridlocked.
Yeah. It still gets jammed sometimes.
And yet, even during the pandemic, that place was packed, even though they weren't taking guests internally. What did they do? They really optimized the way cars enter and leave. They changed the way they routed it. They brought in more staff. They had people in bubble suits outside early on, right?
Yeah.
But they were flexible, and they survived, and their brand has succeeded, right? So it's really... it's part of business, frankly, is the ability to respond and react. The thing is you have to be calm about it, and you have to realize that this is the nature of the world we live in today, and we'd all like it to be the way it was. It'll never be the same. Never.
Yeah.
We'll never go back to the pre-COVID world because a lot of companies, for instance, have jettisoned real estate. There were a lot of companies who said, you know what, we sent everyone home, and our lease came up, we terminated our lease, we're not bringing everyone back at least to that building because we terminated our lease.
Yeah, yeah.
And do we need a building that size with that kind of configuration? If you recall, pre-COVID, open floor plans was all the rage.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Well, open floor plans weren't mitigating floor plans for COVID, right?
Yeah.
Look what's between us, the plexiglass, right? Now you need more of the old school office or you know, walls between employees, right, to be mitigated. So I think the important thing is just to realize that there's never a better time to get back to work.
Yeah.
Get back to work, but do it in a thoughtful way mm-hmm. where you can keep your people as safe as possible. No one can be 100%.
Yeah.
You know, all you have to do is your duty of care and your due diligence. Make sure you're following whatever guidance is available today mm-hmm. and that you're implementing it and that you care and you're trying your best. Mm-hmm. And then move on.
Yeah. 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 I feel you. All right, Tim. Well, it's 3:20. We're about 20 minutes into the show. Let's take a short little, like, couple-minute break here. We'll be back with more with Tim Matthews.
For over 50 years, Hunterdon Medical Center has been a leader in delivering comprehensive medical and health services to our community. Our staff is committed to providing the highest quality of care to our patients. If you need a physician, we can refer you to over 300 of the best. Call Hunterdon Medical Center's Physician Referral Service at 1-800-511-4-HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org.
Are you struggling to find the right person to stay in that critical role in your company? Trying to attract and retain millennials? Retail Personnel is your staffing solution. Located in Lebanon, New Jersey, Regional Personnel is an ASA-certified, privately held staffing and recruiting firm providing you with everything from temporary to permanent employees. As ASA-certified professionals, we employ the latest tools and techniques to find, screen, and present to you the best talent that fits your needs. The result? Access to top talent in the shortest time with the lowest chance of turnover. We guarantee it. So call Regional today at 908-534-8113 or visit us on the web at regionalpersonnel.com.
Hi, I help students gain admission to colleges that are a great academic, social, and financial fit, where they will be successful, happy, and graduate on time with minimal debt. Email Diana at creativecollegeconsulting.com for a free consultation.
Okay, I think we're back. How's it going, folks? Chris Sobieski on the Soapscast show. Normally, this is a time slot for me, Jeannie, and Larry to host our location titled show here in here at the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce radio station. Today in the studio, I have with me Tim Matthews, a good friend of mine. We go back to the old days of East Amwell politics when I first got involved. But today we're talking about, you know, COVID stuff, different risks that businesses face in the current environment. So Tim, we were just talking about COVID and, you know, how businesses start reopening and how to address these current challenges. But there's, of course, other challenges in the 21st century, you know, many related to technological infrastructure. So, you know, this is something that you know, doing your day job pretty much. So, you know, why don't you give us a little bit of an explanation, not an explanation, but, you know, kind of brief us on the different issues that, you know, companies face when it comes to, you know, IT safety.
Sure. Yeah. Happy to. So obviously there's been a lot of change in the way people engage with technology, with the cloud, the big movement to this thing called the cloud,
yeah.
But also the movement of people working from home under the COVID. So imagine a company that had an office environment, a building where everyone had to come in with a badge, very secure access to the environment, sit down at a computer that was connected to a network that had all sorts of sensors and firewalls built into it and people monitoring that network. And it was very well protected as a bubble. And now you immediately send all those folks home to use either a company provided computer or their home computer, mm-hmm. and they're accessing your systems now through the internet.
Yeah.
So you've gone from one location to 1,000 locations, mm-hmm. all connecting from an internet. Each one has its own level of security or lack thereof.
Yeah.
So this has created a big challenge for what we call CISOs, mm-hmm. Chief Information Security Officers, that are out there in industry, because not only do they have to maintain the current environment, mm-hmm. but now they have to worry about all of these user endpoints and where they are, and not just the computer connection, but what's happening to the data in that location, right? So is someone looking over your shoulder and looking at information they shouldn't see?
Yeah.
Are you printing things and leaving them on your dining room table when the house cleaner comes in the next
day? Pulling them up at Starbucks on the free Wi-Fi and somebody's
looking at you on the network. The Wi-Fi, the library Wi-Fi, wherever you're working, right?
Yeah.
So we have this new sort of wide open access points. And then you add to that the ransomware threats, which are primarily coming in through what's called phishing, which is where people try to capture your identity so that they could either fraudulently access systems on your behalf or pretend to be you in order to steal things from you. So we have this problem now where you have people working from home. They might get up from their computer, which is not as protected as you would like it to be, and someone sits down at their computer or they get an email and they respond, though, because they're working on their personal email also within the same computer.
Yeah.
So this has opened up a lot of risk for corporate access to information.
Oh, I'm sure.
So it's keeping people busy. But again, luckily, at least we're not hearing of publicly there have been a few big ones, but we're not hearing about the level that you would hear, what you would think would happen, given how many mid to upper level executives are actually working, you know, from non-secure locations.
To me,
it's an interesting thing. Now, it might be worse than we think it is, and we're just not aware.
I would imagine a lot of corporations probably wouldn't want to reveal to the public and their shareholders that, hey, we're getting hacked over here, and we're, you know.
Or the malware payloads have been distributed, and you know, now they're just running on the networks, and we don't know it. But that is created. That's the combination of the people working from home, and then this cloud-based. This cloud-based move of technology up to these massive clouds, because these clouds become, as anything, bigger targets. Right. So if you're a hacker and you've got targets, why not chase the bigger targets?
Exactly.
Right? So,
go bigger at home, right?
Yeah. So you got these big, large cloud providers aggregating hundreds and hundreds and thousands of businesses running within their cloud. That becomes a much larger target. So if you successfully breach that, you've gotten a bigger payoff than you would if you didn't. So it's definitely the information security people are very busy, very high in demand right now. It's probably one of the jobs that is probably the most sought after
right
now is the information security professionals. And, you know, my hat's off to them. They've done a terrific job keeping our data safe as best as they can, with all things considered that are going on right now. It's pretty incredible.
Yeah. So, Tim, let's say hypothetically I'm like a medium-sized business owner. I have let's say 200 employees, and, most of them, they need to access, their laptops at home to get their work done. Now, what would you recommend for, obviously the big corporate guys have, firms that can handle this, and, they don't need outside help, but for the littler guys out there, what would you recommend that they do to kind of protect themselves and, shore up their defenses against this kind of stuff in this pandemic age?
Well, there's no quick fix. I mean, a couple of things are try to standardize, I think it would be a cheaper solution just to give everyone technology rather than let them
use it
all
at
different levels. Because the problem you run into are people not updating their operating systems.
One
of the biggest risks is just failure to maintain and apply patches. Because the companies that distribute the operating systems, they are very aware of what the latest risks are, and they're good at putting out new patches to mitigate against this. But if people don't upgrade their laptop with the software, then there's a risk. So if you have 1,000 people, or 200 in your case, working at home, and you have 200 different flavors of computing technology and operating systems, it becomes very difficult. So the first thing I would do is standardize, and I would say it's probably a good capital expenditure to just invest in 200 standardized pieces of technology for those people.
Yeah, because at least you have the controller. You know, it's better safe than sorry, right, as they always say.
Yeah.
So let me tell you about something we did in my prior line of work when I was working for a municipality in Pennsylvania. They had a setup on this system, the software called Log Me In, right? And the way that system worked is I could use my laptop at home to remotely access my computer that was at the office, physically. So, in my mind, again, I'm not an expert on any of this by any stretch of the imagination. Something like that seems to be a good idea, right? Because you, I mean, granted, you have access to that computer remotely, but it's, you know, that computer's still in-house where it's supposed to be. And I guess there, I don't know, would there be risks from, you know, in that situation where I'm sitting at home on my laptop remotely accessing it? Like, I mean, I guess it depends on how they're connected, but, like, you know, that would seem like a smarter option than just, like, letting people work, you know, just carte blanche on their own equipment at home.
Yeah, that, right? that's referred to as virtual desktop.
Okay.
And you could even do it where in that model where there's physically another desktop.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And you're logging in. Or you could do it in a model where there's a virtual desktop in the cloud. So mm-hmm. that's a way of standardizing operating
okay.
system and
yeah.
tools. So
yeah.
what happens is you log in from your device and essentially imagine it sort of pushes out of memory your own personal computer and loads in
yeah.
this virtual image. And now you're running in that bubble
yeah.
that is managed by the corporation. Now, the only risk you really run into there is the password protection risk, right?
Mm-hmm.
Are your people changing passwords regularly? Are they diligent about password formats?
Mm-hmm.
Do they have it written down on their desk? You know?
Yeah.
That's always the weakest link, right?
Oh, yeah.
If people give out their passwords or say to their wife, hey, would you log in? I got to sit on a WebEx today or a Zoom call with my boss,
mm-hmm.
but I'm going to go over here and practice my putting on my putting green I have in my living room here.
Yeah.
Why don't you, honey, would you just log in for me? There's my password. It's on the table, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, that's a breach. That's a violation of most security policies. So, but virtual desktops is a good way to go. There are a lot of providers who provide that.
Yeah.
So, again, what you would do in that case is you would create your standard image, put it in a cloud, and then just tell your employees, go in through this internet access, which would then load down essentially that image onto the machine they're running.
Yeah.
And have them run from that. That's a successful.
Okay, so that is a good option for.
Yeah,
okay, interesting. So another topic I kind of wanted to breach with you, and this kind of has to do with, obviously has to do with cybersecurity stuff, but you know, as you remember, there was a couple months ago, there was that hack of the, what was it, the Colonial gas pipeline,
yeah.
right? And as I understand it, that was a ransomware attack, right? I know what a ransomware attack is in a very abstract form, but could you kind of explain what that is and how that works, what happens?
Yeah, so essentially, in the simplest form, imagine mm-hmm. we've created encryption technology to protect us.
Yeah, yeah, right, yeah.
Where you can encrypt things and have a key, a password to get it unencrypted. Well, essentially, adversaries use this encryption technology to lock your own data up. And they mm-hmm. have the key.
I see.
So essentially, they encrypt your data without you wanting it encrypted.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can't access it unless you have the key. And they have the key. And they allegedly will only give you the key if you pay a ransom.
Hence the name ransomware,
I guess.
Okay.
Now, one of the challenges is you're dealing with, you know, essentially criminals. So what's the evidence that they will, even if you paid their ransom, that they will give you the key?
Mm.
And then secondly, if they've given you the key, how do you know that whatever they put on your system to encrypt it in the first place is gone and that they won't do it again tomorrow with another key, right? And this could be extortion, you know, good old-fashioned, you know, roadside extortion where, you know, every time you drive down the road, you're stopped and asked for $20 because someone puts a gun to your head, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it becomes a normal way of life. So the problem with paying the ransom is it's not like you're paying the ransom to upstanding citizens who are trustworthy and have a contract with you. So it's a problem because some organizations have a, you know, zero tolerance policy. They'll never pay a ransom.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with that is then you better have a backup plan because if your code's encrypted and your stuff's encrypted, then it's gone.
You'll never
get it back.
Yeah.
Obviously, there are some really good information security firms that can break into a lot of the encryption technology. It depends on the encryption technology that's used by the adversary.
Mm.
So in some cases, you can get it back. But then instead of paying a ransom fee, you're paying a fee to a professional who's, you know, putting time and effort into.
You're getting raked over the coals one way or another, right?
So the solution to this, or not really solution, one of the things we try to do is what's called air gapping, which is take periodic backups.
I see.
And make sure that those backups aren't connected to the same computer and network.
I gotcha.
So that if your backup or your current production environment was encrypted, you could go back to an earlier version. Now that might be a problem. You might lose a week's worth of sales or a week's worth of order, but you didn't lose everything, right?
But you put it on a cost benefit kind of thing, and you know, it might make more sense.
Yeah. So that's you try to set up a backup regime where again, depending on the importance of your data and what's called the recovery point objective, which is how much data can I afford to lose, you would set that up either to back up every 5 minutes, every 20 minutes, every hour, every 6 hours, depends on your tolerance for risk, right?
Yeah.
If you set up the backup once a day, well, then you could lose a day's worth of data, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, some adversaries are smart enough to know, well, we'll put in our malware payload. We won't ignite it right away. We'll let it land in their backups over a week.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll launch it, and then we now know our code is... So the first thing you would do before you even re-engage that backup is you better scrutinize the data
and make sure
that you can clean it if it's possibly infected.
I gotcha. So, I mean, you got to think, like, the Colonial Pipeline, right? Like, that's a major source of fuel for, like, the East Coast. Not just, like, the East Coast, but, like, part of the South, too, as I understand it. That's a big deal. Right, it's a very big deal because you got to think, you know, with China and Russia and all our adversaries around the world, you know, especially now, it seems to me that they feel a little bit emboldened with the current administration. Disagree with me if you want, but that's how I see it. You got to ask yourself, like, who else is vulnerable, right? Like, you know, the way I'm looking at it, we already have, you know, energy is, I mean, my God, where would we be without the power, right? Like, we saw what happened during Hurricane Sandy, where, you know, most of New Jersey was without a power for, what, like two, almost three, sometimes a month, or months worth of weeks. So, you know, my mind hops to our other, like, power infrastructure and, you know, like our like hospitals and stuff, for example, right? Like how vulnerable are we to this kind of thing on a grand scale? Like, does this affect, you know, like JCP&L or other big, like, companies like this vulnerable to this kind of attack?
Well, so... I don't have insight into all of these organizations.
Yeah, of course.
But knowing the way technology works, again, unless you stay on top of it and do your diligence and monitor, we're all vulnerable. I mean, if you look at what happened in Austin, Texas with the power grid there, that wasn't even a malicious attack. That was just a source of energy was down, and it caused an imbalance in the supply and demand.
Yeah.
And therefore, they had to take down the grid and part of the grid in order to balance the supply and demand of energy.
Wrecked the whole system.
So that was a natural occurrence of ice.
Yes.
We are vulnerable. I mean, to some degree, the technology we create makes us more vulnerable because we depend on it more.
The double-edged sword
the more we depend
human
on
progress,
it, the more vulnerable
I guess, right?
we are.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. It reminds me of like social media, for example. Like, it's very much a double-edged sword in my mind. You know, on one half, it's really good for people to be able to communicate and, you know, stay in touch with each other and to promote businesses and other events and yada, yada, yada. But it brings out the absolute worst in people at the same time, too. And you, unfortunately, get a lot of people who, you know, put a lot of BS on there that isn't necessarily true, whether it be about politics or about other people or what have you. But it's just interesting, like, you know, from a philosophical perspective, like, technology is almost making us weaker at the same time making us stronger. It's a very bizarre kind of phenomenon in my mind.
If
you know?
I could segue to social media.
Of course,
I'm fascinated how social media, which was supposed to open up communication and information, in effect is having the reverse effect because it's becoming something that people are not listening to anymore.
Yeah.
Because of the amplified opinions that either are so one-sided that everyone tunes them out, or with fake information, or at least fake to you, right? Everyone has their opinions, but what's happening is I don't pay attention to social media anymore.
Yeah.
Because to me, I don't know what to believe, and therefore I don't have the time to sort through this stuff. So what was supposed to be this liberating thing to allow me to connect and network with all these other people is in fact limiting me, because I don't want to connect with all these people because I don't know who they are. I
mean,
I don't really know what that community really is. They may present a face and information, but behind the scenes, you don't really know who all these real people are.
Yeah.
So it's just, it's an interesting, and I can't wait to see how this plays out over time.
Yeah.
How social media, whether it's a just a fad, and
it's going to be the downfall of our civilization if we're not already there.
Well, it's no different than rumor mills, right? I mean, it's essentially, it's automated the rumor mill, right? It's created, instead of what we used to play as kids, you know, whisper down the thing, you tell a story, and by the time it comes back, it's different, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now it just happens at warp speed.
Yeah.
Just stuff gets consumed and redigested and sent around until you don't know what to believe, and therefore you don't believe anything. And,
yeah,
and
it's exactly. Creating, like me.
Yeah, it's creating.
I don't trust anybody anymore. You can't. Yeah. You know, everyone's... I hate to curse on air, but there was that old saying, like, you know, opinions are like buttholes, let's say. Yeah. Everyone has them, and they all stink, right?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if you've ever looked into the psychology of, like, how... like Facebook and like all the social media companies kind of operate the same way, like how your interactions with them affect your brain chemistry. So what I mean by this, you know what dopamine is?
Yes.
It's the chemical in your mind that, you know, when it releases, it gives you pleasure, right? So every time you click like the like button, every time you see a notification pop up on your phone screen, your brain's triggering a little dopamine hit, right? So, you know, for certain people, they start... That's how you get these people who are just crazy on Facebook, like, 24/7. They're addicts. They, you know, biochemically, they're addicts, where they're, like, you know... Like I said, every time they get a like, comment, dopamine hit, right? And you got to think, like any other addict, you go crazy when you're trying to chase that high, you know? So I think that's what's contributing to all these people. You know, you see... There's a couple of things. I don't mean to be ranty here, but, like, it seems to me that you get some of the most outlandish opinions on social media than you don't meet people in real life who think this way, right? Now, there's a couple reasons. One, what I just explained, the dopamine hit, and, you know, you got to think, the more insane of a statement you make, the more interaction you're going to get with it, positive or negative. It doesn't matter to you whether it's positive or negative, as long as your brain's getting the, you know, nice pump of the drug. But not only that, but, you know, I think the modern, like, news media, and I use that term, you know, very broadly, they're responsible for a lot of this too. And, you know, not just by throughout their bias, but the way that they report certain stories, right? Like, it's always sensationalist headlines, because that's what gets the most, you know, traffic. That's what gets the most clicks, and that's how they make the most money. And then I think it creates this echo chamber where normal people see, like, ridiculous headlines, and they themselves want to, you know, get the dopamine hit. So they start sharing that stuff around, and it's just a cluster of just stupidity. And yeah, that's kind of where I see the end of humanity resulting from, is us just killing ourselves over stupid stuff like this.
There's
right?
actually another dimension in addition to that, and what I refer to is we're interrupt driven. Right, so if you think about it, we're all about teaching our kids, you know, not critical race theory, I'm not going there, but I'm talking about, you know, the idea of being critical.
Yeah.
Thinking about all aspects. Look at all ends. So that implies...
Not allowed to do that anymore.
Well, that implies that you focus. That you take time
exactly
to focus and think and stay on point.
Mm-hmm.
But we're so interrupt driven with between text and this and that technology that you're bouncing from topic to topic. You don't have time to critically think.
Yeah.
And when you don't have time to critically think, then you're reacting to headlines. And then again, when the headlines aren't necessarily trustworthy. Mm-hmm. Either they're real and they are, but you just don't trust them because you've been so conditioned, or they aren't real.
Mm-hmm.
Either way, that's all you get are headlines, because that's all you have time to consume.
Exactly. Yeah.
And this notion of taking time to sit back and be critical and really think through, why am I thinking the position I'm thinking?
Yeah.
Let me read 5 books on the topic. 3 on this position and 3 on this position, you know, whatever it might be, and think for myself and come up with my own. No one has time for that anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
And to me, that's a problem with this whole thing. I mean, I remember I was on email at work. I'm getting 100 emails a day. I'm there sifting through them. And someone turned on the instant messaging capability of email.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden people cut the line by instant messaging you. Mm-hmm. You know, so if their email was sent yesterday and it's 100 down the stack, I'll get to it in a linear progression.
Yeah.
But now they cut the line by instant messaging me.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually...
It just throws you. Yeah, throws you off.
Yeah, it's like the guy when I'm waiting for my pizza, you know, and people come up and call in, you know. I'm waiting to give my order and the phone rings and the guy stops taking the orders out of line.
Yeah, I know the feeling.
You know, the phone guy wasn't waiting behind me. He just cut the line.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, it's bizarre, man. And you know what, you know, from a political perspective, and you know, you and I have both been in politics, like, I think what the most tragic part of this kind of thing is like, it obfuscates issues, you know, this phenomenon where we're hyper-focused on, like, things for just, like, a split second, you know, the headline, basically, phenomenon, right, where we only get news from headlines and not the stories themselves. It obfuscates the issues, right? Because when something comes up and it's, like, really important, it'll only get, like, maybe a couple days worth of news coverage before everybody forgets about it, even though the story's still developing in the background. Like, perfect example. You remember a few months ago, like, Fauci's emails got released because I think it was BuzzFeed. They, like, FOIA requested them. And there were all these reports that, you know, Biden was trying to get Fauci to step down and, you know, he was going to be out by the end of the week. And here we are, like, 3 months later, and the guy still has a job, and he's still, you know, we don't need to get into my opinions about Fauci, but it just goes to show, like, that was the big story for, like, two or three days, like, Fauci's emails, and then everybody forgot about it, and we just went back to normal and forgot that ever happened. And then, like, another classic example, this is kind of contemporaneous. We had, you know, Andrew Cuomo step down as governor, I think, 2 days ago. Was it yesterday? I can't remember. One way or another. You had the governor of Virginia, right? Northam. I think it's Ralph Northam.
Yeah.
He got caught, like, you know, in his college yearbook, either A, in blackface, or B, in a Ku Klux Klan outfit. Neither are good, okay? It's either one or the other. It's in his section of the book, and everyone forgot about it. And he's still, like, and despite, like, the Black Lives Matter, you know, riots / protests over the summer and everything else that's gone on, he's still the governor. It just blows my mind, but I guess that's what happens. Like, the social media stuff just, like, distracts people so quickly. And
well, I don't know all the facts, but I'm frankly surprised Cuomo resigned. I really am.
Are you? Yeah, I am too, to be honest.
I mean, I've always taken the position, having been an elected official for three elections in 9 years, I've always taken the position that the only responsibility you have is to your constituents.
Mm-hmm.
And it's up to your constituents to vote you out of office.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not up to the I mean, think about what happened here. A district attorney essentially went beyond accusing him of things, stated he did things and committed crimes. There was no trial. There was no evidence. He was basically tried
in the court of public opinion.
In the court of public opinion, and he resigned. I frankly am surprised, and I would have, you know, not, I don't necessarily agree with his politics, but I would have supported him had he not resigned, because I think he deserved the opportunity to have this thing play out.
Innocent until proven guilty, of course.
Yeah, and again, let counter investigations occur, right? Mm-hmm. Like, just like everything else, like the whole Kavanaugh thing, you know? I mean, you got to let things air themselves out. You can't just react. If we would have just reacted for Kavanaugh, for instance, and these accusations came in and he would have said, forget it.
Never substantiated in, like,
yeah, so I was all about, hey, let that go. Let there be a public airing of the facts.
Yeah.
And then let the facts stand. And frankly, I'm surprised that he resigned.
Yeah, I'm surprised, you know, just with how obstinate he's been. I think, you know, he's got the family legacy thing going on. Just make sure I'm close to the mic. His father was obviously governor, and his brother, Chris, is, you know, the CNN anchor. Like, he's got all the support in the world. Well, at least he did at one point. And I don't know. It's like, you know, like I said, I'm frankly shocked just based on his, you know, he doesn't seem like a guy who would be willing to step down, you know, willingly. So maybe there was stuff going on behind the scenes that we don't know about. But to go back to the attorney general thing, I think you bring up a very good point. Just a hypocritical thing I've noticed with this situation. Back in 2016, when Trump got elected, right? Like, the big kind of, one of the big kind of chants you heard from Trump supporters and the right and the Republican Party was, I don't want to say the party, but Republican voters in general, was the, you know, lock her up, right? Like, we wanted Hillary thrown in jail for the email stuff and a variety of other things. And, you know, the criticism I remember hearing from like the mainstream and from the left side of the political aisle was like, oh, you shouldn't be running on, you know, prosecuting your political opponents or something like that, right? Like, you know, basically, like, don't run on the idea of throwing somebody in jail.
Yeah.
But then you have the Attorney General of New York, and granted, it's your job as the chief law enforcement officer to, you know, enforce the law. But, like, she made it clearly political statements, you know, in support of investigating not only Cuomo but Trump as well. And it just seems like a complete double standard where she's able to say, like, oh, yeah, I'm going to run on, you know, prosecuting these people, but Trump can't do that with Hillary. I don't know. It's just very... Well, it's strange.
But I think that gets back to the point is that the electorate voted that person in office.
So,
so it's really up to, you know, if you really believe in democracy and the fact that you know, you can run for an office and as long as you win a legitimate vote, right, a legitimate election, that you now have a mandate based upon what you ran on.
Yeah,
so if if your position is, you know, I'm running because I think that person's a crook and I'm going to do everything I can to get them out of office, and that's my entire... reason for running.
Yeah,
if the people who hear that message vote for you, then they expect you to do that.
Yeah.
Right? Because that's what you said you would run on.
Yeah.
But it's not up to anyone else to derail that. It's up to the electorate then. And that's why I feel strongly that elected officials really, I mean, it's really up to the people who put them in office.
Yeah, that's fair.
Take them out of office.
Yeah.
There is a method. If you don't want to wait till the next election, there is a method like
recall.
Going on in California.
Oh, yeah, that's another.
With the governor there. I mean,
that's
there is a recall.
Worms.
There is a method that that can be used. So you know, we should leave this up to the electoral process and let it play out. And all this other stuff is just political noise.
Yeah. Now, at the same time, though, Tim, I think there's an argument to be made. Like, you know, it gets to a point when you can't function in your job. And maybe you should resign, right? Like, let's say Cuomo was to be, you know, indicted for a variety of, you know, sexually related offenses, and he's got to worry about going to trial, and you know, he's out on bail, and you know, it's become the spectacle, media spectacle, you know, that inhibits his ability as governor to do the job he's supposed to do. Now, granted, I never thought he was doing a good job of it in the first place, but you know, besides the point, like, do you think it ever gets to a point where like? Someone did something so heinous that he really can't wait for an election and he should be stepping down?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think obviously...
If you shoot somebody in the face in broad daylight, then maybe there's
something
like that.
I would say if it's a bona fide crime, indictable offense, and they're arrested, well, then, they can't do their job from behind bars. But until it's been adjudicated, I mean, they still essentially, in that case, you know, while they're... serving their, you know, sitting there waiting trial, the lieutenant governor would jump in and run the place.
Yeah.
But you don't necessarily lose, because what if you're exonerated?
Yeah.
What if it turns out it was all false information?
Yeah.
And, you know, then you should be able to kind of turn time right back to the position you were before.
Think. Yeah.
You would hope. I mean, that's what we hope our Constitution affords every person in the country.
Yeah.
So I think that's up to each individual. I mean, same thing could happen with an illness. You know, if you end up with an illness and you just can't, you don't have the energy or the mental capacity to do your job anymore because of medication or whatever, I think you have an obligation to your constituents to step down and say, I can't serve you due to, you know, this wasn't a situation when you voted for me, but now it is.
Yeah. Things change.
I think just because there's a, you know, a crowd of people out there, you know, with pitchforks saying, you know, hang them, doesn't necessarily mean that's the way it goes.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. Yeah, it's wild. We'll see what happens in California, too. It's going to be interesting with this recall effort. Now, I've seen Larry Elder, of course, I'm a big fan of him. He's leading the pack right now. Are you familiar with how the California, like, recall process works at all?
No, I haven't been following the details of it.
See, I don't know if it's, like, they have to have a Republican primary or if it's just a general recall where there's like Newsom versus like 40 Republicans and, you know, whoever gets the plurality faces him in a second round. I don't know. I need to do some more research on it because I'm interested. But I know the last time we had a recall election in California, that's when Arnold Schwarzenegger got elected, right? He's actually not that bad of a governor compared to Newsom, right? Like, you know.
Well, the good news is I don't live in California, so I'll let the people of California determine whether they like their governor or not.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't know enough about the way their politics go. All I know is how New Jersey works. And you know, you and I, like I said, have been in local politics. And it's an experience everyone should go through.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's both wonderful and frustrating. Because, you know, you really can, at the grassroots level and where the rubber literally meets the road, you can make some changes.
100%.
But it's amazing how it really works behind the scenes, and the fundraising and all the election law and all the things that go with it that are just really make it difficult for people to be involved.
Yes.
It's not as easy as you think to just get up out of your chair and run for office, as you know.
No, yeah, 100%. Well, we only got 5 minutes left, and I wish we got to this sooner, because I would have loved to get, you know, get your, you know, the history of how you got involved in politics on, but we'll have to have you on a future show, I guess. Yeah. Unless you want to, like, quick little explanation how you got involved.
I can give you the quickie.
The quick
one is, so when I first moved into East Amwell, I was pretty much apolitical. You know, I didn't really care. I was just working. But I saw what happened to a new neighbor who moved in next to me. And we're a horse community, and this neighbor wanted to build a barn. And the political government at the time said, no, you can't have a barn for a couple of horses on your property. And they took this person through an eight-month process, spending tens of thousands of dollars. And when I looked into how it all worked, how they, you have to put up a bond, and then the professionals appointed by the politicians get to essentially spend the money out of the bond and drag it out. And it was just extortion, essentially. Yeah. And I saw this, and I said, this is wrong. And I decided to run for office. And I ran the first time without any support. I was the only Republican. It was five Democrats. I was running for one of the seats as a Republican. I had no support from the county, from the state, from anybody. I literally funded my own campaign, did it on the cheap, and I came within 26 or 27 votes of winning the first time. And I think people got interested. Then I won the following year and won. That's what got me motivated, was seeing, and not only seeing it, but doing the diligence, reading in. How does that happen? You know, doing the critical thinking that's necessary.
Right?
Using my own brain to figure out what was happening here. And I uncovered this very powerful organization in our little town that was handpicking all of the professionals and putting all of the residents through hell just to get anything done, just to line the pockets of people.
It's a shame.
And I just couldn't let that stand.
Yeah, well, luckily there was a happy ending. I mean, I guess the story's still being written, but, you know, things have changed. We got a 5-0 Republican board now.
Got to watch out so we don't fall back into that, right? Because power corrupts absolutely, right?
Exactly. Oh, I've seen it firsthand, believe me. Well, that, you know, Tim, I get people who ask me, like, around my age, right? I'm 28, for people who don't know. Like, they see that I'm involved in local politics and stuff, and they're always like, Chris, like, how do we fix this country? How do we get things back on track? What can I do to, like, you know, to do something, right? Because a lot of people feel helpless. They see what's going on. They see cities burning on, you know, the nightly news. They see, you know, the virus wreaking havoc across the country. People are stealing, you know, our freedoms are being eroded day by day. You got people flooding over the southern border, who, you know, without any degree of organization. God knows what kind of, you know, viruses they might be carrying. Probably many of them have COVID. You know, the list goes on. But, you know, what I've been telling them is to, you know, try to get involved at the local level, like run for office. And, you know, I think something that's always frustrated me is when I see people, you know, not just on Facebook, but in general, they're always complaining, like, oh, you know, what is this guy doing? They don't know what they're talking about. Like, this, you know, this politician sucks, or this other politician sucks. Well, look, if you don't like him, like, step up and get involved. Because frankly, like, I think that's a lot of what goes on, unfortunately, is, like, not enough good people get involved, and then you get people who, like a good example I could give would be, like, you know, let's say, I don't know, like, the governor's race in New Jersey, right? Like, we had the primary a couple months for the Republican side. Like, you had Phil Rizzo, you had Hirsch, and you had Jack Cittarelli all running, and there's some other guy, Levine, who was there. But he didn't do as well as the other three. But, like, you know, Jack has been involved in politics for, you know, a good amount of time. Like, you know, understands how things work. And, you know, to his credit, he was out, you know, storming the whole state, going to various Republican clubs, trying to get the vote out, and, you know, really putting in the groundwork. But the other two guys, you know, to their, you know, not to say that they didn't do any work on it, but, like, you know, Jack had been making the necessary friendships he needed to make across the state with, you know, local Republican organizations, because those are the people who volunteer and get things done. While, you know, Rizzo and Hirsch, it seemed to me, were kind of more like, you know, running the social media game and not really doing the in-depth groundwork. So I guess to kind of bring you into this and to stop rambling, like, like what would you suggest to people who want to get involved and want to change things, who want to get involved in politics at any
level?
Yeah,
what I would suggest to anyone at any age is even before you have to feel getting involved, because even that might be a big lift, be an audience.
Mm-hmm.
Go to the meetings.
And the very
least. If you fill a room, Chris, you know, when we're in the township committee, when there's people in that room, there's transparency.
100%.
There's eyeballs on you.
Yeah.
And people are watching. And watch what they're doing. And don't just listen to the headlines. Just don't take the information from trusted or pseudo-trusted individuals. Do your diligence. Read. I would suggest to anyone, if the border, if you feel the border is an issue, read about the border. I mean, go out there and look at real bona fide peer-reviewed articles. Mm-hmm. Read. There's millions of things out there. I mean, the internet is wonderful in terms of bringing sources to you.
Yeah.
School yourself. I mean, we have time to watch Netflix binges of 20 episodes of some show. Take some time to educate yourself on the issues, but be an audience.
Yeah.
At least go. And just sit in. Even if you just sit there and eyeball these folks, you're going to keep them more honest than they would be if no one's in the room.
Yeah, I agree. All right. Well, it's 4 o'clock. We've been here for an hour. Tim, I want to thank you again for coming out. It's been a pleasure.
This was a lot of fun. Yeah. I enjoyed it.
We'll do it again sometime.
I'd love to do it.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have opinions. It's amazing how much you can cover in an hour.
Oh, for real. I know. We didn't even get into any really controversial stuff. Believe me, I talk about all types of wild stuff in here. I get into, like, you know, conspiracy theories, like who killed Jeffrey Epstein and all this other. A lot of fun things going on in 2021. You know, just as there are a lot of bad things going on, but you know, we'll keep positive. So that's it for today, folks. Thanks for tuning in. We'll catch you next Thursday. I'm out. Peace.